This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. On February 8, 2013, I visited the Bergen University for Canine Studies in Rohnert Park, California, and spoke with Bonnie Bergen, founder of the school, and two veterans of the Iraq War about a new program there called Dogs Helping Veterans. I'm going to begin tonight's program by airing that interview with Bonnie and the veterans, and then I'm going to move on and play a recording of Hugh Martin, another Iraq veteran, reading from his book, The Stick Soldiers. This was recorded at the Word Temple Poetry Series in May of 2013. But right now, let's start off with going to the Bergen University of Canine Studies and hear how Dogs Helping Veterans is working to help our veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder. This is Catherine Hastings. I'm pleased to present this special program focusing on the Bergen University of Canine Studies in Sonoma County. My guests include Dr. Bonnie Bergen, who founded Canine Companions for Independence in 1975, and then went on to found and serve as president of Bergen University, home of the Assistance Dog Institute since 1991. She's the author of numerous books and publications, including The Smartest Dog, The Selection, Training, and Placement of Service Dogs, Bonnie Bergen's Guide to Bringing Out the Best in Your Dog, and many others. She has received about a dozen awards and recognitions, among them the Use Your Life Award from Oprah Winfrey, the Presidential Points of Light Award from President George Bush, and a Distinguished Service Award from the President's Committee on Employment for the Handicapped. Bergen University of Canine Studies is the world's first and only academic institution dedicated to advanced education and research in human-canine partnership, business, and companion dog studies, and leading-edge assistance dog training. And the university has a new program, Dogs Helping Veterans, that we'll focus on in just a few minutes. Joining Dr. Bergen are two veterans, one from the Army and one from the Marines, Steve Moore and Daniel Fudge. We also have a couple of dogs here, Ella and Foster, and I want to welcome everybody. Bonnie, today is my sister Lori's birthday, and when I was talking to her about how I was going to spend the day, she went green with envy, and we decided that you're probably one of the luckiest people on the planet. Not only have you turned your life's work into spending time with dogs, but you have the bonus of turning a life with dogs into really magnificent purpose. Helping people with disabilities lead richer, fuller lives, and that sounds like such a cliche, but in this case, it's so true. So would you take just a minute and tell me how you started all of this?
Oh, yeah, I'd be happy to. I was in a master's class, and interestingly enough, I was in there to learn about disabilities, and I heard a lot of people talk about what they were going to do to help people with disabilities not be institutionalized or at least stay in institutions. And I couldn't buy their answers. It just didn't seem possible. Stainless steel on the walls in institutions didn't strike me as the best approach. And I just sat there, and all of a sudden, it was like an epiphany, and I just went, dogs. Dogs could get out and really help these people outside. Now, I knew nothing about dog training, so it wasn't as though I had some knowledge backing me when I came up with that idea.
Well, it would literally take days to talk about all of the programs that Bergen offers. Time I'm willing to spend, but since we have just a half hour for this show, let's talk for just a minute about the assistance dog training provided here, and then we'll move right into your new program, Dogs Helping Veterans. So what disabilities are served in the assistance dog training program?
Assistance dogs cover a wide range of roles, hearing dogs, dogs that work in social therapy settings, but the service dog, which is what we concentrate on, work with people who have multiple sclerosis, muscular dystrophy, any kind of ataxia, some kind of muscle weakness. Most of them use wheelchairs. And a lot of the dogs are doing amazing tasks like turning lights on and off, picking up dropped items, tugging open doors, and just about anything someone wants a dog to do that a dog's capable of doing, they're being trained for.
So I'm going to turn to Daniel Fudge now. Daniel, you served in the Marine Corps for 5 years, spending 3 years in the Presidential Support Program. That's probably another radio show right there.
Yeah,
and 2 years in the Fleet Marine Force. When did your service begin and end?
It started in November 2007, shortly after I graduated high school. And then it ended November 12th, 2012.
Do you want to tell us what Dogs Helping Veterans program is all about?
Yes, I'd love to. So Steve and I are actually going to be the instructors for this program. The underlying purpose of it is going to have veterans with PTSD come to the school. They're going to use our dogs.
And PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes, that's correct. And they'll be coming to the school, and they are going to learn how to train service dogs. From there, these dogs will then be placed with veterans who need service dogs, whether it be for emotional support or if you have a double amputee, triple amputee, or anything else. So,
do veterans have to pay for the training that they get here?
No, they don't. Because it's a nonprofit organization and it's a very therapeutic benefit for them, we don't have them pay. It's actually a two-way, it benefits two people. Both the students get to interact with veterans with post-traumatic stress or traumatic brain injury, and also it helps them because they're working with the dogs. Now, when they train these dogs, they're training them for other veterans. Now, the veterans that are going to be placed with the dogs that are trained in this program, those veterans don't actually have to pay for the dog.
Where do the funds come from?
They come from generous donations of individuals who love dogs and would love to support and help veterans with PTSD and traumatic brain injury.
So listen up, everybody. Good. Do the veterans coming in to get the training use their own dogs, or do the service dogs come from elsewhere?
Unfortunately, right now, we are not accepting veterans to bring their own dogs because there's just a lot of factors to consider when you bring in your own dog. And for us to have the highest probability of success in this program, this is the first time around that we're doing it here at Bergen University. So we're going to stick with using our own dogs and that we've bred for service dog temperament and have already had some training, and we're hoping that it's going to have the highest probability of success with these individuals.
Sounds like it will. Daniel, how many vets are in the program right now?
Currently, we have three individuals who have committed to come. Both Steve and I are going to be the instructors, and we will be aided by a number of Bergen students. And Steve and I are both veterans ourselves, and it sets a very warm tone having other veterans come in being taught by veterans. So in order to have that same tone with the Bergen students who are not veterans, we are having them go through a six-week course to learn about post-traumatic stress syndrome, traumatic brain injury, and military customs. After this course, we hope that they'll be able to be very familiar working with veterans, very familiar with working with these disorders, because not only is it going to be important for these individuals here that come to the school, the veterans who come to the school, but after these students graduate, it's a growing field, and they'll be able to go and approach different veteran hospitals and say, hey, look, I've worked with these people before. I have dog training experience. Let's set up a program. Let's start helping these people out. So hopefully it'll grow here at the school as well. We're starting out with three, and we're hoping that we can get more.
With the reputation that Bergen has already, I would think that would not be difficult to do. And, you know, it used to be that we would go into a war, get out of a war, and then we would have years and years no war. And now it just seems like a way of life. So it seems like this program in particular is really vital.
I hope it has great benefits on the individuals who come.
So, Daniel, you're a veteran, but you're not a veteran with disabilities. What is it that you're getting out of this program yourself?
For me, I never went overseas. I never went to a combat theater. I went on ship and I floated around the Pacific for a little bit. And for me, when you're a veteran, you've joined a brotherhood. And when you see your brothers that are struggling, you can't just stand by idly and not do anything about it. So for me, I enjoy being around veterans. I enjoy helping veterans because it helps me give back to something that I was never able to be a part of.
Thank you so much, Daniel. Steve, let's turn to you now. This is Steve Moore. You enlisted in the Army right before the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001. And you ended up serving less than a year later in Iraq during Operation Iraqi Freedom One. Why don't you talk to me about your experience?
Well, like you said, I joined right before the World Trade Center attacks. I was actually in school, so they signed me up on the delayed entry program. And then I remember watching the news, knowing that I was getting ready to go to boot camp and train, probably to go overseas. And it was pretty unreal. But at the same time, I was young back then. I was a little bit excited about it as well. I was dating somebody that worked at the college with me, and 6 months later, I went to boot camp, finished that up, and joined the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment just in time to train up and go overseas to Iraq for the beginning of the war. Lots of fun.
Oh, not at all, not at all. You thought you were going to be away for 6 months, and you were gone for a year in Iraq, and then you came back to Colorado with just enough time to recuperate before being redeployed to Iraq for another year. What was happening with your family? You were a newlywed at that time, weren't you?
That's right. So my ex-wife and I had been dating for quite a while, and we knew we were going to get married. So like a lot of young, smart people do, we decided, you're going overseas, let's get married right now. Mm-hmm. And I flew her out 2 weeks before we deployed, and we got married in a courthouse with her family there. And then the idea was, and this is traditionally the way it happened, was you figure 6 months deployments, and then you come back home. I don't think anybody was prepared with the number of soldiers it would take to occupy the country of Iraq and as well as Afghanistan at the same time. So midway through the deployment, we figured out that it was going to be a year long. And then we came home with just enough, almost literally, we got off the airplane and we had our orders to go back again in less than a year. So it was about a little over 10 months before we were back from 2005 until 2006. For OIF-3.
You actually had a couple of children during this time?
I got my wife pregnant right after coming back from the second tour. So okay. I had 6 months in between coming back from Iraq the second time and then moving back to Santa Rosa with my family. So Joshua, my first son, was born just after moving back to Santa Rosa. Okay. And then not long after that, a couple years after that, we had our second son, Aiden.
And you are, unfortunately, one of the vets who came back with post-traumatic stress disorder. Is that right?
That's correct. So I got out of the Army in 2006, and it took until 2012 until I actually would admit to myself that I had a problem with anything. My wife, early on, as is the case with most of our wives, realized that I was struggling with things. So she basically made me go to the VA hospital in San Francisco, where I was diagnosed with PTSD. That wasn't good enough for me, but I mean, I was ready to, I guess, put everything behind me and carry on with life. So I buried myself in work. I was working 80-hour days for a long time. And eventually, of course, that's not a real good recipe for a healthy marriage either when you have two kids at home either. Yeah. So things started to fall apart at home. And not that a few years ago, my wife and I split up. And because of the diagnosis that I got at the VA, she was able to get full custody of my kids. And I mean, in retrospect, I suspect that was rightfully so, even though back then I was very mad about it. So the time between our separation and coming to this school was a very dark time for me. I couldn't rationalize any of it, and I wasn't really trying to, but I was getting into a lot of trouble with the police, and I was drinking heavily. Eventually, I got arrested for a DUI. I was on a motorcycle going really fast, and the police officer arrested me, and the court basically told me that I have to go get help for PTSD at the VA hospital here in Santa Rosa, which I did reluctantly. And it wasn't so much that it wasn't helpful, because the doctor up there put me into a group for OIF veterans, which helped me a lot while I was in the group. But I couldn't take anything that I was learning in the group and apply that to what was happening in my real life. And
soldiers go off to war, and when they come home, we think, okay, they're home from war, but they really bring the war home with them, don't they? It's not over.
It never is.
Gone through something like that.
Right, it never is. And I mean, I've been doing a lot of work recently here at the school to try to help my fellow students understand what they're getting into, as well as help in my own recovery, because I've only started even trying to recover since coming to this school. But talking to people about the kinds of experiences I've had and the kind of experience most of us have when we're trying to reintegrate back into society, which is very difficult. Mm-hmm. I think that the real breakthroughs that I had, what came from attending this school, which was basically on a fluke.
It was a fluke.
A happy fluke, yes.
What was the fluke?
Just one day in my OIF group, somehow we were talking about Pause for Purple Hearts, which is a program that Bonnie Bergen started. And I was trying to find out about it because I love dogs. And I spent probably 2 years after I got arrested locked in my house, not doing anything with the outside world. And I thought this might be a good chance for me to take advantage of something that I enjoy and get out of the house. So I called her. I was looking around the internet trying to find out about Pause for Purple Hearts. And I got a phone number. I can't remember the guy's name. I can't even remember where he was from. But he told me about Bergen University. And I called. And basically the same day, I was enrolled in their associate's program. Wonderful. For assistance dog training.
That's wonderful. Yeah. And now you have Foster.
Now I have Foster.
Beautiful black lab with, I think, the biggest head I've ever seen on a dog. Great dog. So how did coming here and starting to work with these dogs make you feel?
It was amazing. For 6 years, I didn't feel anything. I mean, truly, I've gone through at least 5 therapists, and I've told them all my story. And the only thing that I could think while I was talking to these people is, why, when I'm the one that's supposed to have all the problems, are you crying? And I don't feel anything.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
So coming here and working with these dogs that are designed to make you feel like you, mm-hmm, has just been a miracle. I've actually gotten up in front of a graduation ceremony. I've gotten up in front of my classmates and talked to them about my experiences, and I'm the one crying now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's absolutely beautiful. Just beautiful. So What do you hope to accomplish by completing all of your training here for the Dogs for Vets program?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say, and as many different problems as somebody with PTSD faces, the big thing for me is the way you respond to extreme threat, which is a constant overseas, is going to be stuck in the on position. So even the smallest threat or something that's viewed by, as a threat for somebody like me is going to be experienced with a pretty severe emotional outburst, as if I was still overseas. And that's usually, that's typically going to be an angry outburst, unfortunately, for whoever is involved. And it, as we all know, any number of negative consequences can happen from that. Coming to Bergen has given me the opportunity to work with dogs that have helped ground me. And there's so many people out there that don't have that ground. And I'm just so excited to be able to have the opportunity to share some of that with some of my fellow veterans. And I think in the future, as the program expands and as we all go out there and start our own programs, that's going to be even more and more prevalent across the country and here at home with more and more veterans that need the help.
I hope so, because this is just such a high purpose. It is such a high purpose. Thank you so much.
Anytime.
Yeah. So Daniel and Steve, after you had a semester of training, you became student teachers of the group of clients that came in to receive service dogs. And coincidentally, it turns out that there were three vets in that assistant dog training class that had PTSD.
That's correct. The three individuals that we worked with all had PTSD. And it was an amazing experience. One of them, I specifically remember our first field trip we took. We all went to the mall and we walked around, and to see him he was hypervigilant, having trouble kind of when he first got in. There was a lot of people. It was during Christmas time, tons of people around. But he had a black lab. And as he slowly started moving around, he stayed kind of along the edges. But by the end of the field trip, you could tell he was feeling more comfortable. And that was just a small piece. And by the end of the 2 weeks, to see him go out on a field trip and be able to go out and smile and have fun and have a conversation with us and not be so worried about who's coming up on his back, who's coming at him in front. It was a really uplifting experience.
After just 2 weeks.
Yeah, it was a
That's
2-week
amazing.
Process. So, it was good.
I think the most memorable thing about the whole 2-week process for me was at the end on stage, all three of the clients getting their dogs, and they were all smiles. They couldn't wait to get their dogs, get on the airplanes or their trucks or wherever and go home. But probably the thing that made it all worthwhile, and it makes all of this worthwhile, is one of their wives actually came in and spoke to us as a class, and she was crying and just so thankful, and I'll never forget, she thanked us all for giving her husband back.
So the work you're doing is helping vets, but it's also helping many more people.
Oh yeah. We had a mother who called in of one of our veterans and just expressed the joy that she felt now with her son. The relationship that they had established now after him getting a service dog was really heartwarming.
Thank you, dogs, and thank you, vets, working in this program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Bonnie Bergen, I want to swing back to you now before we end this program. I knew before I walked in the door this morning that this Dogs for Veterans program is really important. After talking to these two veterans, that feeling is just absolutely multiplied by about a million. So I want to thank you for starting this program. It's starting very, very soon. What would you like to say? If there's one thing that you want to say to the listening audience right now, what is it?
I'd like to be able to say one thing, but that never happens for me.
Say several.
I think there's two really important components to this program, and one certainly has been expressed by both Dan and Steve about the value of the dog and what the dogs can bring to people's lives. Mm-hmm. But I want to underscore the value of people, in this case, Dan and Steve, and what they are going to be bringing to people's lives, because I think that it's the teamwork between dogs and people that enriches all of us. And I think that that has to be a real message that people hear.
This is Catherine Hastings. It was both a pleasure and an honor to sit down with Bonnie, Dan, and Steve at the Bergen University of Canine Studies. Although Dogs Helping Veterans is a new program at Bergen, the university has been placing dogs with veterans at no cost for several years and has seen amazing results from this partnership. Dr. Bergen worked with a psychiatrist at the VA for over a year to develop the program, and that psychiatrist was so impressed with the positive changes that she witnessed with a participating veteran that she actually became a volunteer consultant to help with further development of the program. Since then, several other psychiatrists and therapists have joined in the discussion and have referred their patients to Bergen to become the first participants in the Dogs Helping Veterans program. These veterans are in some type of counseling along with the Dogs Helping Veterans program, and clearly the combination is helping a lot. If you'd like to know more about this program or other programs that Bergen University of Canine Studies has to offer, you can go to bergen.edu. That's bergin.edu. Or call 545-DOGS. That's 545-3647. Thanks again to Bonnie, Dan, and Steve, and of course to all of the wonderful service dogs who make life so much brighter for so many people. And that concludes the portion of the program focusing on Bergen University of Canine Studies. In just a couple of minutes, I'm going to air another Iraq War veteran who is also a poet. This will be Hugh Martin reading from his award-winning book, The Stick Soldiers. But before that, here is Lawrence Ferlinghetti performing his poem, Dog.
Dog. The dog trots freely in the street and sees reality. And the things he sees are bigger than himself, and the things he sees are his reality. Trunks in doorways, moons on trees. The dog trots freely through the street, and the things he sees are smaller than himself. Fish on newsprint, ants in holes, chickens in Chinatown windows, their heads a block away. The dog trots freely in the street, and the things he smells smell something like himself. The dog trots freely in the street, past puddles and babies, cats and cigars, pool rooms and policemen. He doesn't hate cops, he merely has no use for them. And he goes past them and past the dead cows hung up whole in front of the San Francisco meat market. He would rather eat a tundra cow than a tough policeman, though either might do. And he goes past the Romeo Ravioli factory and past Coit's Tower and past Congressman Doyle of the Un-American Committee. He's afraid of Coit's Tower, but he's not afraid of Congressman Doyle. Although what he hears is very discouraging, very depressing, very absurd to a sad young dog like himself, to a serious dog like himself. But he has his own free world to live in, his own fleas to eat. He will not be muzzled. Congressman Doyle is just another fire hydrant to him. The dog trots freely in the street and has his own dog's life to live and to think about and to reflect upon. Touching and tasting and testing everything, investigating everything without benefit of perjury. A real realist with a real tale to tell and a real tale to tell it with. A real live, barking, democratic dog engaged in real free enterprise with something to say about ontology, something to say about reality and how to see it and how to hear it. With his head cocked sideways at street corners, as if he is always just about to have his picture taken for Victor Records, listening for his master's voice, and looking like a living question mark into the great gramophone of puzzling existence. with its wondrous hollow horn, which always seems just about to spout forth some victorious answer to everything.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. Let's move on now to an evening at the Word Temple Poetry Series in May of 2013. One of our featured readers that night was Hugh Martin, a veteran of the Iraq War, where he served 6 years in the Army National Guard as an M1A1 tanker. He was just 19 years old when he deployed and participated in hundreds of missions, including raids, conducting foot patrols, clearing routes for IEDs, disposing of unexploded ordnance, and searching thousands of Iraqi vehicles. And then he began writing poetry. His chapbook, So How Was the War?, was followed by his first full-length collection, The Stick Soldiers, published by BOA and awarded the A. Poulin Jr. Poetry Prize. He also won the 2012 Jeff Charlotte Memorial Award from the Iowa Review. A recent MFA graduate at Arizona State University, he is a Stegner Fellow at Stanford University. So up next is Hugh Martin. He's going to read from the very painful, cautionary, and most necessary collection, The Stick Soldiers. Unfortunately, I'll have to edit some language out, but you will get the gist. Here is Hugh Martin.
Thank you very much, Catherine, for organizing this. Should I get closer? Okay.
You're tall, too.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Steve, for coming. Thank you. Thank you all for coming tonight. I'm just going to read some poems from the book, mostly, and then I have two or three that I read that are new. And just to give you some context, like she was saying, I was in Iraq in 2004, about 80 miles north east of Baghdad, for approximately 11 months. We were in charge of two towns, Jalul and Sadia, mixed Sunni, Kurd in those towns. And so basically, like she said, I mean, that summary she read from somewhere online, I was able to do a little bit of everything, I guess, which you can get tasked with certain missions in Iraq, like just clearing routes or just, pulling guard duty or just going and guarding council buildings or whatever. But we were able to do a little bit of everything, which actually is good because it kept us from getting complacent and things like that. So, but this first poem is, I'm going to start with kind of deploying to Iraq. And it happened when I was in my second semester in college, and I was called up, and we had to go over there. We trained at Fort Bragg about 6 months and went over there in 2004. And the word, just that word Iraq, became sort of a cuss word for us, because we heard it so many times. You know, you hear it in the media, TV, papers, and then in training. And so it became like this forbidden word that no one wanted to hear about it anymore. And we hadn't even gone over yet. So the epigraph for this is just called, it's just from a soldier, my friend in a bar in Leesville, Louisiana, after getting his 35th tattoo. Just, I don't want to hear that four-letter word. The poem, four-letter word. One, at Fort Polk, Louisiana, the opposition force shoots all three of us. But we enjoy this death, which gives us a chance to sit, smoke, and rest our feet. Dying is part of training for war in Iraq. We leave in 2 months. Two, my Aunt Joan hates that I'm going. She talks at the retirement home, saying Iraq, the four-letter word, like trying to spit food from her mouth. Three, killed when his convoy vehicle struck a roadside bomb. Killed when a roadside bomb hit his vehicle on a mountain patrol. Killed when his unit was ambushed with small arms fire. Killed. Four. On the slow computer in the internet and phone center, I say the names of the dead. Age, hometown, cause of death. IED, RPG, small arms, car bomb, things to be avoided. Five. Home for Christmas leave. This is our son. He's going to Iraq. He's leaving for Iraq. His unit is being mobilized for Iraq. He has to go to Iraq. I'll get you a drink. You're going to Iraq. Email me when you get to Iraq. Hopefully things will get better when you get to Iraq. Are you scared about going to Iraq? Did you know you would have to go to Iraq? I can't imagine going to Iraq. Is there a chance you might not go to Iraq? Where will you be in Iraq? What will you be doing in Iraq? How long will you be in Iraq? Iraq? Really? Iraq? 6. My chemistry professor asks why I'm withdrawing from class. She says, email your address. I'll send you guys cookies. 7. At Ohio State with Jake and Larry, we walk from house to house, keg to keg, drink beers from a book bag. When I wake on white carpet in a living room, I'm not sure what has happened, but I'm still going to Iraq. 8. Channels went home for Christmas. He never came back to brag. He's AWOL. LT says the marshals will find him within a week. 9. Asleep in the barracks, 3 a.m., 2 feet hit the floor. Someone runs. Tomorrow we will know it was Spencer, to the lighted latrine, and 3 paces from my bunk, spew lashes across the red floor as if dumped from a bucket above. But he doesn't stop, vomit falling as he runs. And in the stall, after coughing up the rest, a slow breathing, cold water in the sink, he sucks it from a cupped hand again and again. 10. At the high school football game, Dan and John shake my hand. They stand in thick, unzipped jackets. When we lean left with the hundreds of heads watching the ball in the air, soaring to our home end zone, I feel the tremors in my chest, the silent crowd inhaling to explode, the open mouths, the arms, the screams. I'll read an older poem about being in Kuwait. We were in Camp Udari, Kuwait, waiting to cross the border. And try to see closer. And so we were at Camp Udari, Kuwait, and this is a poem from my chapbook, but it's also sort of that pre-Iraq stuff that I have in here. And it's just called Tomorrow We Go Up North, and up north was sort of this euphemism, I guess, for Iraq. Tomorrow we go up north. Night before we cross the border, some of the guys stand outside the tent and drink non-alcoholic beer. I crack one and take a sip. It tastes like shit, but I drink half just to stand with everyone else. The beer reminds us that the desert we stand on is real, that tomorrow we will place the bullets into the chambers of our weapons. Never would any of us drink non-alcoholic beer except for tonight. Thomas, the tall medic, bought the fake booze at the PX, and as someone walks in or out of the tent, he pulls a wet, dripping can from the bucket of ice and says their name, and you want a cold one? No one says anything, except if they call their wives or kids on the satellite phone. I called home, no one picked up. I told the answering machine I was leaving in a couple weeks, a lie for operations, security, OPSEC, the captain yelled all night. I dump the other half of the beer behind the tent and walk past Davis and Benson, who are betting on how many miles it will be before we get attacked. Inside, everyone still packs their duffel bags and rucksacks, stuffing them until they bulge. And one of the, I don't know if Steve knows about these, but one of the worst jobs you get in Iraq is like guard duty, being assigned to, I don't know, guard a certain area of the base or guard the front gate. Basically, most of the time, it just means you're staring at the desert, just staring at Iraq. And so, and you might be put with someone in the guard post who's annoying and just won't stop talking, or they don't want to talk, or I don't know, you're just never comfortable. So, but this poem is sort of based in that. We call them guard posts or observation posts, and this is a little bit of an experience about being in one of these posts. Just call it an observation post. Hanley spits strings of saliva-laced dip into the gravel. Hours ago, a dud dropped on the south side of the fog and sent up a breath of dust. Marwan, the interpreter, drives to the entrance gate, picks up his two boys. Their summer job, filling sandbags for dinars. At the intersection, 1 mile down the road, a 3-round burst, a precise incision through the windshield, neck, mouth, nose. We drive with the captain in a Humvee and find the two boys crouched together, hands over heads on the floor, their father wet on their bodies. Captain takes a photo, and we lean toward the backseat window as he points at red scraps of Marwan beside the seatbelt buckle. Later, he'll show everyone, magnifying the camera's screen. That's skull right there. That's skull, as if needing others to agree. We watch crowds carry the wood coffin through Sadia's streets. Peshmerga arrive in jeeps with RPGs, Kalashnikovs. They drag suspects to the police station where they'll take turns with the rifle button. I'm cleaning my fingernails with the Gerber, and Hanley whispers, "A shooting star." When I look, he says, "Go f*** yourself." Before dawn, we see movement in the retreating darkness. Through the binos, a donkey mounts another in a field. When our relief shows up, we say, "If you're bored, two donkeys are f***ing at 3 o'clock. A dud hit before midnight. Marwan is dead." So I have, there's some poems in this book that are sort of, one of my teachers, Norman Doobie, he helped me out with this kind of, but he gave, just made the point, you know, the book sort of needs poems that are, I guess, relief from the most of the content, and maybe they, I don't know, they're lighter stuff. So I have a few of these in here, and people seem to like this one, a couple of my friends said they liked it, so. I'm sure you know most soldiers going to war now, in the last 10 years, they're bringing cameras with them. Everyone has a camera, pretty much. And so we had a lot of these disposable Kodak cameras. And this is, it's sort of a prose poem about, a story about that, about having this camera. And it's just called Pictures of the War. When I send home a disposable camera so my parents can develop the film, see pictures of the war, I don't know that Ellis stole it and photographed his penis. Giggling with a wad of dip nudged behind his lip, he tells me weeks after I send it how, sitting on his bunk, he'd simply pulled up his black boxers, pointed into the darkness, and clicked. I imagine my mother taking the glossy photos from the envelope as she walks out of the store. Since I'd already taken up half the roll on the drive from Kuwait, Ellis's picture was somewhere in the middle. Most likely, she'd thumb through that section and see row of mud homes, children shouting for candy, rusty T-72 tank, penis. The question was whether or not she'd recognize it. She might think her son is with a bunch of men in the desert, the penis a part of some joke, and move to the next photo. Or maybe she'd slowly flip through the pictures and study each one, thinking, my son is at war, this is what he sees. And upon gazing at the close-up of the penis, think only how it reminds her of penis, and scold herself for such thoughts. She might just stand there, squint, and move in closer, and after a few seconds become fearful, presuming it was the blurry result of a camel in the desert darkness. My mom did get those photos. That is a, I don't like to say, you know, poem is nonfiction or fiction, but that, it did happen to my mom. I don't know, just, you couldn't really tell anyway, so it was just dark and things like that. So, but that one, that's based on us, it's sort of a true story, but my mom didn't notice really at all, so, or at least she didn't say anything. So. Okay, I'll read a few the rap poems now. Our base that we were at was, the bases are called FOBs, well, most of them are called FOBs, or the ones I was at, the forward operating base. And ours was FOB Cobra. And I have a few poems in the book that are just sort of portraits of soldiers. And this is sort of set up as a regular night or like an off night on FOB Cobra, kind of what was going on base. And it's just called Friday Night FOB Cobra. One. Smith, shirtless, curls 40-pound dumbbells. Veins burst like worms over his biceps. The curls are part of his plan for home, a sex life. Two. On burn detail, Richie stirs shit with a metal rod. Asks Carter, standing back with the smoke, doesn't it make you hungry? Three. In Tower 10, Stevens discusses mutual funds, interest rates. He says a young guy like me might spend all his money on a bike, a truck, a house. He's taking his wife for a cruise, investing the rest, and that's what you do with money. Four. Jones' brother sent him a 12-pack of ultra-sensitive lifestyle condos. The box reads, almost like wearing nothing at all. He cuts it out and tapes it to the front of his flak vest. Five. When asked why his hands are so hairy, Kenson says, with a cup of coffee in one of them and a ball of wet Copenhagen bulging in his lip, I ain't a f***ing girl. He sips 4 pots a day, changes the grinds once a week. The coffee tastes of steam and heat. Six. Kellerman's wife divorced him over email. Seven. Ski boils water in a canteen cup, adds ramen, slices of expired Slim Jims. He discusses the juices, how the heat pulls in for flavor. He says this meal is sacred. Eight. Sergeant Thompson has been in so many fights, there is no cartilage left in his nose. In line for the phone, he shows us, bending it like an ear with one finger, flat against his cheek. Nine. On marriage, Perry says, it ain't like that. You think you just walk in the door and she hands you a beer and gives you a blowjob. It ain't like that, he says. Just wait. It ain't like that. Ten. Sprinkling hot sauce over cold boiled potatoes, Dempson talks about reading the paper, the names of the dead. All of us know he slept with 97 women. After we finish our food, he tells us about one. This is called The Burn Pit Detail of Fog Cover. We stand in the Humvee steel bed and heave bags of trash with both hands to the wide crater below. We throw piles of open boxes sent from our mothers and the USO. We push out the bent, rotting lumber left too long in the sun. We toss the torn tires of Humvees, the sandbags that split in half. We burn everything, and we stand beside the blue smoke of our war's leftovers. When the bed's empty, we light cigarettes, watch outside the wire. 300 meters out, past the four rolls of concertina wire in a wide field of desert, two of the stray dogs fight. They jump to their hinds, mouths wide for each other, but between the flashes of burn pit smoke, they seem to be in a dance, a moment before a kiss. Though just when their lips meet, the pit glows, the smoke thickens, we can only see their long shadows collide and fall. At dawn, we'll send a detail to gather the dog who lost. With a snow shovel, they'll scoop the body into a double plastic bag. To keep the dog from becoming a bomb, like everything, they'll dump it to the flame and ash of the pit. And I'll just read up. It's been about 15 minutes. Well, yeah, I'll read two more. So that's not 15. That's what I read for 20. So this is 15. This is, it's kind of opens up the book. It's one of the opening poems. It's called The First Engagement. You run with the others over gravel, looking up at the dirt burn wall that's around your home, Bob Cobra. And you climb to the edge that ends against sky. You push with boots, claw the loose dirt with one hand, hold the rifle in the other as the terse pops of warning shots go silent. At berm's edge, beneath the crooked Kevlar cover, you peek to see the hundreds of meters of mortar-beaten land, and then, while you're there, a white truck moves down the broken asphalt road. Orange sparks, hundreds, splash from its tailgate. A vehicle-borne IED. It could be headed to the village just north. It could be headed for the main gate. Inside the truck, the driver can't see, or does not see, or doesn't care to see. You, the dozens of rifles, the Bradley's black cannon aimed to the windshield, the hood, his own head, his passenger's head. You steady your rifle atop the berm, and first, the Bradley fires, its orange tracers, almost gentle, weightless, as they fly to meet the truck's grill. The platoon follows, down the line they fire together. You aim your first shot, but the truck slows. When you adjust, your foot slips. You fall below the edge, unable to see. A lieutenant yells, "Ceasefire." Silence. So this is it. No one knows the man who's dragging rebar from the back of his truck. No one knows who's taking it to rebuild his home. No one knows his son, the passenger, is shot in the arm. No one knows the man who's shot in the leg, the stomach. All you know, an hour ago, three mortars fell from the sky for you. This vehicle with sparks is for you. It's only day three, and how many more until you can go? Steam rises from the hood. The blown tires sag to the concrete. The rusted bumper hangs beneath shattered headlights. And from the space where a door used to be, the man falls to the road for you, for the Bradley, for all the men, to show just how you've done. I'll just read this. I have one short last one. Kind of. It's kind of a strange poem. It's basically when we go out and clear roads for IEDs for our supply convoys going out in the early morning. We'd run into strange things happening, and it was after curfew, so no one was really supposed to be out. And one day there's a car coming a few miles down the road we saw through the hills, and these men were just kind of shining a big spotlight out the window into the hills, and there's just nothing in these hills. Just kind of blank, empty, dirt hills. And so we stopped them, and we found out that they were just working for the telephone company, and they were just driving around during night, shining a spotlight at the telephone wires to make sure no one blew them up, and no one basically messed with the telephone wires. And it was, what happened next was a little strange, and then the poem kind of takes in a different direction, but that's what this is based on. It was very weird to see this, because it was just so futile to be driving around guarding the telephone wires with the spotlight. And it became sort of funny in a way. So it's just called The Leg. On the road that weaves between the dark slopes of desert, a small car moves slow. With rifles aimed, we watch it closely because of the strange beam of light that shoots from its passenger window into the hills. We wait it down to stop. One man drives this blue Volkswagen, its doors held shut with string. Another man holds a spotlight pointed from the open window. We search. No shovels, no rifles, not even the usual knife for shearing sheep. I walk into our Turk, who has his face covered, all but his eyes, with a khaki scarf. After the men speak Arabic, the Turk says they've been hired by the phone company. Each night they drive while shining the light, watching for anyone who might cut the wires, blow the lines. Sergeant Kenton says, what do they do if they see someone? The Turk speaks, and the man who had held the light runs to the car, leans his body through the open window, and jumps out holding, it must have been sawed off from a dining room table, a thick, polished wooden leg. The man smiles and swings the leg left and right. When he spins across the road as he swings, not showing any sign that he'll stop, as if wanting to demonstrate the capability of this table leg, all of us, the platoon, the Iraqis, laugh. Hard laughs that go deep into the desert. Even the Turk, always scared for his life, mouths out long screeches of laugh. Babylon is only a few hours south. Somewhere near, cuneiform began on tablets of clay. Most of us from the state Ohio, named after the Iroquois, OEO, Good River. In 2 weeks, the Coalition Provisional Authority will transfer power to the interim Iraqi government. Many people in America have yellow ribbon magnets on their bumpers. It's getting late, but the man just keeps swinging the leg, and everyone's laughing, some of us to tears. Thank you.
This is Catherine Hastings. You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. You just heard Hugh Martin reading from his latest book of poems, The Stick Soldiers, published by BOA. Before that, you heard a special segment of tonight's program with Dr. Bonnie Bergen, founder of Bergen University of Canine Studies, along with Daniel Fudge and Steve Moore, two Iraq War veterans involved with the Dogs Helping Veterans program. I'm going to go out now with Peace on Earth by Rachel Farrell. If you have any comments or questions about tonight's program, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening. When there's none in the woman, and there's none in the man,
children to my right, somebody's beating their wife. Tell me where is love? Where is the God in your life? How can we heal the wounds of the world if we cannot heal love? And where does this be? And I